Can third-party solar energy companies sell power directly to customers, or does that undercut the state's utility providers? One of the questions currently before the Iowa Supreme Court. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We spend this hour examining several cases currently before the Iowa Supreme Court. We'll also hear about a case that involves sex and HIV, a case involving negative campaign advertising, one that could have a long-lasting impact on how politicians go after each other, and a lawsuit against Drake University brought by a Des Moines service dog trainer who was allegedly asked to keep a dog out of classrooms. Our legal analysts today, Todd Pettis and Ryan Kopmans. We'll get started right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we like to, a couple times of year, we like to look at the goings-on at the Iowa Supreme Court, and as we approach spring, we want to look at this spring session and tap into some legal expertise we have in Iowa to return to our studios to tell us about some of these cases that may have implications for us. For instance, can third-party solar energy companies sell electricity directly to customers, or does that undercut the state's utility providers? One of the cases we'll be looking at today. Also a case that involves sex and HIV, a case involving negative campaign advertising and how that could perhaps have an impact on how politicians go after each other, and a lawsuit against Drake University brought on by a Des Moines service dog trainer who was allegedly asked to keep a dog out of classrooms. We'll hear the stories behind those analysis and the import of them from Todd Pettis, Associate Dean for Faculty and H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Todd, welcome back to our studio.
Thank you.
Also, Ryan Kopmans with us, attorney in Nyemaster Goods Litigation Department, also editor-in-chief of the appellate blog On Brief. Ryan is in Des Moines. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Keith. Thanks for having me back.
Let's start off with criminal cases, if we could. Ryan, in your corner, I guess we'll put that. This involves the criminalization of HIV, a case called Nick Rhodes v. State of Iowa, a case that necessarily requires that we talk about some details of sex. And if that's something you as a listener don't want to hear, you should turn down your radio for, I'd say about 10 minutes. Ryan Kopmans, tell us the story behind Nick Rhodes v. State of Iowa.
Well, it starts, I guess, in 1998. The Iowa legislature passed a criminal statute that punished the transmission of HIV. And it didn't just punish people who intentionally transmitted HIV, but punished anyone who intentionally exposes another to bodily fluids that could result in the transmission of HIV. Back in 1998, of course, even then, it was not exactly known how HIV was transmitted or perfectly whether it could be transmitted through oral sex, for example, and how. And the Iowa Supreme Court made some broad statements in 2000, 2006, that, of course, oral sex, you can transmit HIV and, of course, unprotected sex. And they didn't require any evidentiary issues for this. They just found as a matter of judicial notice, I guess. They took judicial notice of these facts. Well, fast forward a few more years. And Nick Rhodes, in 2009, was in Waterloo on an online chat room, met someone, a college student. The college student and him got together that night, had oral sex, unprotected oral sex, and then sex and used a condom. The college student later found out that Rhodes did have HIV, although his HIV load was very low. The police arrested Rhodes and charged him with this criminal statute for transmitting or knowingly putting someone at risk of transmitting HIV. Rhodes hired a lawyer and then pled guilty. Essentially, he thought he'd been caught. I mean, he did know about his HIV status. He did not disclose. I've said that earlier. Of course, if you disclose to the other person your HIV status, then there is no crime. The crime is in the non-disclosure. pled guilty and was sentenced to 25 years in prison. The judge later reduced that to time served, which was about 18 months. But now Rhodes has appealed and was called post-conviction relief. He's come back to court with a brand new set of lawyers from Lambda Legal, and what they're saying is that his original counsel was incompetent, that his original counsel should have told him that he had to intend to expose the partner to bodily fluid, and that if he wore a condom, perhaps, and that wasn't showing the requisite intent. That case went up to the Iowa Court of Appeals, and the Iowa Court of Appeals rejected his claim, and now it's at the Iowa Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. So he's trying to say that merely having sex alone with someone is not enough. You have to get into to more details, such as whether a condom was used, not simply whether sex happened and whether consent and information about the HIV was given.
That's right. So he's saying, A, the oral sex, he's saying that it was nearly impossible that the partner could get HIV from the way in which they had oral sex. And then he's saying because he used a condom during sex, he did not show the requisite intent. Now, the Iowa Supreme Court has pretty much said that those factors are probably irrelevant. They said that before. But the fact that the Iowa Supreme Court has decided to hear this case might mean that they're willing to take a look at that again. They're willing to take a look at the additional evidence about how HIV is transmitted, the probability that it will be transmitted if bodily fluids are exchanged in certain ways.
Does this point out perhaps a weakness in the law, that it's unclear of what it means to expose someone to HIV?
Well, it is a little bit unclear. The Iowa Supreme Court has dealt with that a little bit. They've tried to clarify it, and they essentially have said having sex with someone is exposing them no matter what happens. But I think cases like this often offer a good jumping-off point to have a broader discussion, to see the law in application. And so while this case is before the Iowa Supreme Court, what we're seeing in the press and also in the legislature are discussions about the public policy, about the extent of punishment, about maybe we should differentiate people who intentionally try to transmit this disease, because, of course, that was the original – one of the original fears. You had people out there actually intending to give the disease to someone else. Should that be punished more harshly than someone who does all that they can to try not to expose the other person to their bodily fluid? Maybe they should have a lesser sentence, 5 years. Mm-hmm. That's all being discussed.
Is there any dispute, any gray area over what constitutes informed consent here?
No, not in this case, because Rhodes didn't disclose at all to the partner that he had HIV. And in fact, I believe his online profile indicated the opposite, that he was HIV negative. So that's not an issue here. The only issue is about his intentions and whether he intended to expose the partner to HIV.
Mm-hmm. What about the issue of punishment, the punishment being ratcheted back from the initial sentence?
There's an article. It's a little bit unknown about how or why it happened. BuzzFeed had an article recently that suggested that maybe the district court judge, after hearing some facts, reached out to Rhodes' counsel and suggested that he might apply for relief from the sentence. And after he did that, a few short months after originally sentencing to 25 years, he reduced the sentence to time served. Mm-hmm. And then I should also mention that Rhodes is now on the sex offender list, and anyone who gets convicted of this is on the sex offender registry and all that comes with that.
Yeah, and so the sex offender registry lasts for how long? A lifetime?
I believe it is a lifetime.
Mm-hmm. So where does this case stand? What is the status of it at this time?
It's being argued next month in March, and we should probably hear from the Supreme Court sometime this summer, if not before.
Mm-hmm. Is this case getting attention outside of Iowa in legal minds?
It is getting attention everywhere, not just in legal minds, but I think more as a matter of policy and how we should be treating HIV and whether we should be treating it differently than other sexually transmitted diseases.
Mm-hmm. In what ways is it being it seems like there's been an evolution in the last perhaps 10 years in treating this, since these laws were written.
Well, in treating it and it seems in how it is transmitted. So you have both ends. So again, Rhodes's HIV load level is extremely low. And so there's issues about, well, what are the actual probabilities that he could spread the disease? And then given how they had sexual intercourse and the precautions that they took, what are the likelihoods?
Yeah.
And on the flip side of that, you, of course, have, well, at the end of the day, should all these risks, even though it might be a low probability, should it still be a matter of informed consent? Should it be the partner that is in the position to decide whether they're taking that risk or not?
Mm-hmm. Do you see what do you see as implications depending on how this is decided after it's heard?
Well, it could go. Something could go through the legislature. Senator Matt McCoy has introduced legislation in the past to reduce the penalties. Maybe that could be reintroduced. Or it could – nothing could happen. And that's – that actually could weigh on the Supreme Court's mind, because the Supreme Court earlier has decided that it's basically if you just have sex with someone and don't disclose, that's enough regardless of how precautious you were. And the legislature didn't change the statute in any way. And sometimes when that happens, courts say, well, the legislature knows our interpretation. The legislature hasn't changed the law, so that must be what the legislature meant. So we could see changes. We could see nothing. And, of course, this is a very controversial issue, and we have an election year, so maybe nothing this year.
Okay. We'll keep our eye on it. Nick Rhodes v. State of Iowa, one of the four cases we're looking at today on a review of Iowa, some of the Iowa Supreme Court cases currently going on in this spring session. Ryan Copeman's with us, attorney, and Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa. Let's move to another criminal case, if we could. This is a case that asks whether a third-party solar energy company can sell power directly to customers or whether that undercuts the state's utility providers, a case stemming from an Iowa Utilities Board ruling against a Dubuque solar energy company. Ryan, tell us that. It's the case is Eagle Point Solar v. Iowa Utilities Board.
Yeah, this is another one that's getting a lot of national attention. And, of course, we're a big producer of alternative energy here in Iowa, but most of the time we think of wind energy. And apparently, according to some, we should be putting more into solar energy. And this case kind of brings up that debate. So in Iowa, we have a heavily regulated utility system like they do in almost every state. And that happens because utilities are essentially natural monopolies, meaning it's most efficient to have a very large company, a very large factory, a very large power plant. So the state essentially allows these monopolies to grow and grow, and it gives them exclusive territories. So no one can come into their territory. No one can come into Alliant Energy's territory and sell electricity if they're a public utility. And in exchange, Alliant agrees to serve every customer in that territory, even if it's very costly to serve someone, say, for example, out in a rural area. It's maybe more costly to serve them than they make. So it's highly regulated if you are a public utility. And the question here is whether this solar company, Eagle Point Solar, is a, quote, public utility under Iowa law.
Mm-hmm. So what did they set up?
So they set up a solar panel system on the city of Dubuque on their – they proposed to on their buildings. And Eagle Point would own the solar system, but then and then would sell the electricity on a per kilowatt basis to the city of Dubuque. And that's where the problem comes in, is that they were selling the electricity. Had Dubuque just purchased the solar panels themselves and produced their own electricity, that's okay. You can go out and buy a gasoline generator, start it up, and produce your own electricity. That does not make you a public utility. So
any one of us can do that, and any entity can do that for itself.
That's right. So long as you're using it for yourself, and actually you can sell it to some of your neighbors, less than five, so long as it's predominantly for your use. So, you know, the lights go out in your neighborhood, you start selling, you know, hook up lines to your generator. That's okay. But here they're proposing to do this to Dubuque, and of course they're proposing, Eagle Point is, to do this to other companies that are willing in the area. Well, the Iowa Utilities Board sees that as a problem because it undercuts the exclusive territory, and it undercuts the benefit to the other major utilities who are already having to serve everyone else. And so the question again, though, is whether Eagle Point is a, quote, public utility. And the definition of a public utility is a little bit circular. It's anyone who furnishes electricity to the public for compensation. So the question really comes down to is this selling electricity from this one solar panel system to Dubuque, is that selling electricity to the public? The utility board says yes. Eagle Point says no.
Mm, interesting. So it sounds like here another case where perhaps laws are sufficiently gray that we have to have it go before the court and perhaps have some new laws written?
Yeah, and it is gray. And again, it's a jumping off point to talk about what the law maybe should be because people haven't necessarily anticipated what's going on here. And one of the reasons why Dubuque just doesn't buy the solar panels outright or lease them and finance them is they can't take advantage of the tax credits. So it's essentially a way to get around that and to give Dubuque the benefit of the tax credits. And now actually we have legislation that's been introduced in the legislature this session and has made it through the funnel that would most likely make it okay for what Eagle Point is trying to do. And it would also require other utilities like Alliant Energy to buy 105 megawatts of power from solar energy. So it's boosting that. Going back to the Supreme Court case, one of the big issues, though, is whether this gray area, as you said, it is gray about what is a public utility. It's a little gray about whether it's for the Iowa Utilities Board to decide what a public utility is or whether it's for the courts to decide. And that depends on whether public utility requires some kind of expertise, and this is a careful balancing of interest here, or whether it's such a usual term that we all use that courts can interpret it. And that's another thing that the Iowa Supreme Court must decide.
Mm-hmm. You said this is getting attention from outside of Iowa. What sort of attention, and how could that shape the future of solar energy in this region in the country?
Well, the Wall Street Journal covered it. Other major newspapers have covered it. And other states are looking at us, and they're looking at doing the same thing. So it's received attention in that way. And anytime you receive you're talking about alternative energy and what we're going to do in the future, people are interested. And what Eagle Point says, if this doesn't go through, then that's going to hurt solar energy. And so you also see groups from all around the country coming into the Supreme Court and giving them their views. I mean, this case, it's not just between Eagle Point and the Iowa Utilities Board. You have briefs filed by the Association for Electrical Cooperatives, Mid-American, the Environmental Law and Policy Center, the Iowa Environmental Council, the Solar Small Wind Energy Trade Association, and the list goes on and on. So people are really interested in this topic. I think most likely it's going to be solved at the legislature, not at the court, but we'll see.
Okay. Ryan Copeman's with us. We have a few minutes before we have to take a break. Todd Pettis, we want to get to a couple cases you're going to tell us about. Any comments on the cases that we've heard so far from Ryan?
No, I think you put them in a nice little nutshell. These cases get complex when you start. The briefs you can are not available on the Iowa Supreme Court's website. You've got to do some hunting to track them down. But once you dive into them to see what the arguments are that the attorneys are making, all of these cases just get extraordinarily complex. And as you know, Ryan says, the different entities that have interest, they see a case like this happening, and it's much more than just one party versus a city. Others see implications coming down the road about what the court will say here. And the court's got the very difficult job of trying to sort through all those things, not say anything when deciding this case that they're going to regret later or that seems ill-informed somehow, but yet not reach out too far and try to solve all the world's problems in one fell swoop. So they've got quite a job on their hands.
Todd Pettis, would you take us through another case, a civil case that we're looking at involving negative campaign advertising? Perhaps some of our listeners will remember this, the case that could have some long-lasting effect on how politicians go after each other. Behind the story of State Senator Rick Bertrand and Rick Mullen. We've got about 5 minutes before we take a break. Take us through this case.
Yeah, this is a case that was argued before the court late last month, late January. Two men, both businessmen, both from the Sioux City area, both named Rick Bertrand and Rick Mullen. Rick Bertrand is the Republican. Rick Mullen is the Democrat. And they went head-to-head in an Iowa Senate race in 2010. And during the course of the campaign, Rick Mullen and the Iowa Democratic Party put up a television ad that said, in essence, that Rick Bertrand's company had distributed a dangerous sleep drug to children and that Rick Bertrand had put his own personal profits ahead of the health of children. Rick Bertrand is a businessman. He owns a number of businesses, but he does not own a pharmaceutical company, and he himself has never sold a sleep drug of any kind. What Rick Mullen and the Iowa Democrats were trying to capitalize on is that Rick Bertrand had, for a period of about 10 years, worked for a large Japanese pharmaceutical company that sells many drugs. There is a division of it that sells a sleep drug, and there were allegations by the FDA and others that there were problems with that sleep drug, but Rick Bertrand himself never had anything to do with selling
that
drug.
He never worked in that division.
He never worked in that division at all. He, as I understand it, worked in a division that was responsible for selling a diabetes medication. And so you can look at it most favorably to Rick Mullen, the Iowa Democrats. They would say, well, even if he himself wasn't responsible, he still worked for a company that was unethical. Rick Bertrand says, well, that might be the claim you were making, but that's not what the ad said. The ad said that my company distributed a dangerous drug and that I put my personal profits ahead of the health of children. So that case went to the jury, Rick Bertrand claiming that he had been defamed, false things had been said about him. He says that it harmed his businesses. His customers went down. He ran into trouble when trying to get a loan from a bank and so forth. The jury came back with a verdict of about $230,000, 30 of it or so against Rick Mullen, the 200 against the Iowa Democrats. The trial judge said that seems a little excessive. I'm not terribly confident in the way these damages were calculated. So Mr. Mullen – or Mr. Bertrand, rather, I'll give you a choice. You can either take $50,000 in damages or a new trial. And Mr. Bertrand said, I don't want either one of those. I want to go to the Iowa Supreme Court. I think the $230,000 were appropriate. And in fact, I think the jury should have been given a chance to consider punitive damages and a much larger check that Mr. Mullen and the Democrats would have to write. Mr. Mullen and the Democratic Party are saying, well, this case never should have gone to the jury in the first place because this is political speech. In the case of a political campaign, hyperbole is the norm. And when you actually look at the ad, you've got to do some thinking and processing to tell, does it really say anything that's false? Maybe there's an implication in there, but that's problematic. There's some questions about the jury instructions, whether the jury should have been told what that implication was.
We're going to pick this up after the break because I know there's more to this story, and I know Ryan Copeman wants to get in here too. But let's talk for a minute before the break too about political speech. We as consumers of political speech on the TV, on the radio, wherever we see it, I think have a different sense of truth when it comes to political speech, or should have. I think Stephen Colbert coined it best when he called it truthiness. Is that reflected in our legal system? Do we look at political speech differently when it comes to the veracity of that speech?
Yeah, there's kind of a legal point of view on political speech and a cultural point of view. The cultural point of view on political speech, you know, to be cynical, would be say, oh, you can hardly ever trust what politicians say. You run an ad, and if you're thoughtful at all, you ought to know that there's a lot of shades of meaning, and then a given ad is really going to twist things. That's kind of maybe a cultural view of political speech. The legal view is that political speech is the preeminent form of speech. And when it comes to First Amendment protection, there is no kind of speech that gets stronger protection than political speech because political speech is absolutely intrinsic to our democracy.
Meaning no stronger protection than for political speech, meaning if there's one granule, one nugget of truth in a claim, it's true.
It means as a general matter when we talk about political speech that if there's a reasonable argument to be made that this speech ought to be protected, odds are very high that the courts are going to say that it's protected because voters are need to be able to hear all points of view, all different nuances of meaning and make up their own mind. And as a general matter, courts are very reluctant to come into political speech and try to squelch it.
Todd Pettis is with us from the University of Iowa, Ryan Copeman's as well. And we were talking about cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. We'll pick up with more conversation about this fascinating case between two politicians here about the extent of political speech. We'll talk about that. And also, we'll talk about a lawsuit against Drake University currently before the case, brought by a Des Moines service dog trainer. A few other topics, looking at legal cases before the Iowa Supreme Court this hour. We'll be back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We've invited a couple of legal minds here in Iowa to go over some of the cases before the Iowa Supreme Court this session. Todd Pettis is with us, Associate Dean for Faculty in the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation, the University of Iowa College of Law in our Iowa City studio. Ryan Copeman's with us, attorney in Nymaster Goods Litigation Department, also editor-in-chief of the Iowa appellate blog On Brief. And before the break, we were talking about an interesting case that really asks the question, how far can you go stretching the truth? How much truth does there have to be in a political ad? And we've all seen these attack ads and come to our own conclusions about that. But this is actually a legal case that looks at it. Todd Pettis, remind us what this case is about.
Yes. Again, very briefly, Rick Bertrand was a Republican running for state Senate in the Sioux City area, and Rick Mullen was a Democrat running for the same seat. And during the campaign, Rick Mullen ran an ad with the help of the Iowa Democratic Party suggesting that Rick Bertrand's company had sold a dangerous sleep drug and that he personally had profited by putting his own he had benefited by putting his own profits ahead of the health of children. Rick Bertrand filed a lawsuit saying I do have companies, but none of them have sold drugs, and I never personally sold a drug. What I did is I worked for a sleep drug. I worked for a pharmaceutical company. I sold a diabetes drug, but I had nothing to do with this large Japanese company's sale of the sleep drug. He got a jury verdict for $230,000. Saying that the ad was false, it had harmed his business, it harmed his reputation. The ad implied that he personally was out selling this drug and profited in his bank account from the sale of this drug, and it wasn't true. And the jury believed him and gave him $230,000. The trial judge had some questions about how those damages were calculated. Now the case is in front of the Supreme Court.
Depending on how it has decided, what is that issue here in terms of what is defamation in this context, in this political context? Defamation is different than it would be for you or I or private citizens, let's say.
Well, it would be different for me, Todd Pettis, but it'd probably be different for you, Ben Kiefer, because the question would be whether you are a public figure. Mm-hmm. The law of defamation is different for private people and for public people. Celebrities, people whose names are commonly known, or people who hold public office are regarded as public figures. And the law says about them that we get a lot of leeway in talking about those public figures, and they're subject of their topics of debate sometimes. We might say things about them that have a little more of an edge than we would about someone who's private. So for a public figure like a politician and possibly like you, if you were to sue for defamation, if the law sees you as a public figure, what that means is you have to show by what the law calls clear and convincing evidence. That's a very high standard that the person who said these bad things about you said them either knowing they were false or they were very reckless with regard to whether what they were saying was true. Mm-hmm. And the jury found that Rick Mullen and the Iowa Democratic Party had acted in exactly that way. They either knew what they were saying or implying was false or they acted very recklessly.
Mm-hmm. In the Iowa Supreme Court, what are the arguments you're hearing that tells you that the justices are kind of looking at this from all angles?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You can go on their website, and although you can't access the briefs for the cases, you can see video of the oral argument. This case was argued in January, and so you find your way to the webpage for January 2014 oral arguments, and you can see the exchange between the attorneys and the justices, and you can kind of see the pros and cons of a verdict one way or the other emerging. Justice Waterman asked a couple of questions, for example, suggesting that if we uphold the verdict here, and that is make Rick Mullen and the Iowa Democrats pay something at least for what they said in the ad, wouldn't that possibly have a good effect on politics? It means that politicians would have to be more careful about what they say, and it might also mean that more people are interested in getting involved in politics because they know that if they do get involved and someone attacks them, that if they go too far in the attack, there'll be some legal remedy. Chief Justice Katie, looking at it from a different point of view, at least for a moment, said, well, you know, on the other hand, if we uphold this verdict, isn't that possibly going to squelch public debate about politicians? And so, for example, isn't it fair game that someone in politics, at least, if someone worked for a company that's regarded as unethical, is that not something that would be a fair topic of conversation when deciding whether that person is fit for public office? And so a lot of pros and cons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ryan Copemans, you've been listening to Todd Pettis explain this one. What do you see is interesting about this particular case?
Well, I think Todd sells himself short. I think he's a public figure. He's kind of a legal rock star. So
he's got to be in my category.
Yeah, I think he's up there.
Get clothes on so you can have some mudslinging happen to you too, Todd.
There you go. I think what's interesting about this case, and sometimes you have to look at it, and this is what the Supreme Court is doing, it's not just about this case. It's about what the legal principle is going forward and what we want and what we think about these issues. And one of the things is going to be, do we want random eight-person juries deciding truthiness, or do we want the voters deciding truthiness? And that maybe doesn't fit exactly into the legal framework, but it's definitely weighing on the justices' minds, and I think that regardless of how the decision comes out, we'll see that happening. And, of course, history is repeating itself. This isn't the first time that politicians have thrown mud at each other or the first time that they've actually sued. We don't see them sue very often because the standards are so high. But actually, we have a case coming out of Iowa many years ago, and it was then Congressman Harkin was running for Senate for the first time. He put out an ad that criticized a staffer of then Senator Jepson and said that this staffer, who was a military liaison, wasn't really coming in at all to help Iowans with their government contracts. In fact, was just getting government contractors to donate money to Senator Jepson. This staffer sued. He said that implies that you think that I solicited campaign contributions. Well, Federal District Court Judge Charles Woolley said, no, I don't think so. He was on the Iowa Supreme Court. He said, this is protected First Amendment speech. They went up to the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, which covers Iowa, and they said that while political commentators often decry the low level of campaign tactics or rhetoric, the debate which accompanies public examination of candidates for public office lies at the very heart of the First Amendment and is essential to our democratic form of government. They then threw out the case. And I think you might see something similar here, but it's hard to tell. And as Todd said, the justices were going both ways on it, and they were considering all these issues.
Okay, what is the timeline here when we'll find out?
Go ahead.
This was argued last month, and again, this one will probably come out sometime before summer or during the summer. This one they might put a little bit more thought into, and we may see it in July or August.
Ryan Copemans with us, also attorney Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa, going through several cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. Let's finish up with this one. This is a definition of protected class. I think a civil case, Todd, correct? But something that one party argues should be a criminal case. A lawsuit against Drake University brought by a Des Moines service dog trainer who was allegedly asked to keep a dog out of classrooms. Nicole Laura Shoemate is the name of Drake University Law School. Actually, Nicole Shoemate has been on this program to talk about her company, which trains dogs, at least in part, as service dogs for returning veterans who suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. But tell us the story here, Todd.
Well, Nicole Shoemate, in or about 2006, enrolled at the Drake University Law School, and that also, I think, is about the year she founded a nonprofit group called Pause and Effect to train service dogs for various populations who would benefit from them. She alleges that the Drake Law School refused to allow her in late 2009 to enter classrooms with dogs that she was trying to train. She also alleges that a professor who teaches, I think it was a faculty member who teaches at Drake Law School, denied her admittance to a theater event or some such event at a local church. Drake denies those allegations, but we haven't yet gotten to the stage of trying to figure out whether those allegations are true or false, what really happened on those days when she said she approached those venues with her dog. Right now, the whole focus is, should this case even go to trial? More specifically, does she have a legal claim? Does she have any kind of a claim that she can bring? And to just step back from this for a second, if you want to sue somebody for something, there has to be a law somewhere that tells you that under those circumstances you can sue. So if someone looks at you in the grocery store in a way that you find unpleasant, they kind of look at you dismissively. There's no statute, there's no line of Supreme Court cases or anything that says, well, bring them to court and tell them to look at you more pleasantly next time. So there's a limited number of things that you can sue for. And the question here is the denial of her entry with a service dog, is that something that the law has said she can sue for? Now, there's a statute, and it's a criminal statute, that says that it is a simple misdemeanor, that is a low-level crime, kind of akin to speeding or something, I imagine. It's not a felony. It's a low-level crime, but it is still a crime to deny entry to certain public places to someone who is training a service dog.
Okay. This is not someone who has a sight disability who needs a dog. This is someone who has no disability who is simply training a dog.
In this case, that's right. The law says it's a crime to deny either of those people admission. So if someone who needs a service dog is denied admission someplace, that's a misdemeanor. And it's also a misdemeanor to deny dog trainers admittance to the same places. She notified the police. She, I think, notified the local county attorney. The county attorney declined to do anything about it. So she's has filed this lawsuit seeking damages that she suffered. So the question is, in this case, when the Iowa legislature made it a crime to deny admittance to certain places who are training service dog to certain people in certain places when they're training a service dog, when they made that a crime, did they also intend to give people like Ms. Shoemate a claim that they could bring against whoever it is that denied her the mm-hmm. admission?
And so is it a criminal or is it a civil case?
It's a civil case. She hopes. Okay, it's either no case at all in the sense that she has no claim to bring, or if she does have a claim, it'll be a civil claim. But it'll be a civil claim that's kind of lurking between the lines or beneath the surface of a criminal statute.
What is Drake University's take on this?
Well, again, Drake University denies that they ever denied her admission in the way
that it just didn't happen. Yeah. Her account did not happen.
Yeah, but accepting her allegations as true at this point, they say that the Iowa legislature did not intend to do anything more than make this a crime. Okay, and so if we did what she says we did, the worst we ought to be facing is some kind of a fine that we have to pay the government, akin to what you have to pay when you're caught speeding or something, but that's the extent of it. She says no. Ms. Shoemate says no. The legislature really wanted me to be able to sue, presumably for tens of thousands of dollars. For example, business losses that she suffered. She wanted to be able to train dogs that could provide service eventually to people who need to be in classrooms. And she would argue that, well, by not being able to bring my training dog into a classroom, I never got the dog trained up in those ways.
Do you see this case actually going to court, Todd Pettis?
It's in court now in the sense that the Iowa Supreme Court has to decide whether she has a claim. If she has a claim, you know, both parties are going to have to make a decision about whether they want to settle or whether they want to go to trial. Most cases ultimately settle. To the extent she has a good reputation for doing good work and training dogs, Drake might make the decision that they don't want to proceed any further. On the other hand, Drake might see this as an occasion where they need to really stand firm and draw a line of some sort and go to a jury and make their argument that they never did what she alleges. So, you know, it's a complicated set of evaluations that they'll have to make. But all those thoughts, I think, are on hold right now, waiting for this decision. Does she even have any right at all under the law to collect damages? If the court says yes, then maybe there'll be settlement talks, and if not, they'll go to trial. If the court says no, then the case is over.
Todd Pettis with us, along with Ryan Kopens, and we're talking about the Iowa Supreme Court and cases before it presently. Let's clean up with a few issues here. Actually, look forward, Todd Pettis, to other issues you see, not in this session, but perhaps coming our way toward the U.S. Supreme Court that interest you.
Well, the cases that are really going to dominate the headlines from now until early summer at the U.S. Supreme Court will almost undoubtedly be the cases having to do with the so-called contraception mandate, the requirement that employers of a certain size provide health insurance that includes coverage for pregnancy-related things like contraception. And Hobby Lobby and another company, run by people who have strong religious convictions, the owners of those companies and the companies themselves are saying that they have a right to exercise their religion, and as they would exercise their religion, they don't want to provide the contraception coverage. And so one of the issues the Supreme Court's being asked to decide in these cases is, do corporations have a right to exercise religion? Mm-hmm. People clearly do, but do corporations? And we know corporations have a right to speak. We know that from Citizens United and even from cases that long preceded it. But can corporations exercise religion? You kind of start to think of, you know, cartoons where corporations are appearing to St. Peter at the pearly gates. But so do corporations have rights under the law here? And if the corporations don't, do the people who own all the shares in a corporation, can they say that even though I'm running a for-profit corporation here, that my own religious principles can kind of infuse the company and that give me the right to say that I'm not going to provide certain kinds of health care coverage to my employees? The court's rulings in those cases are going to get a lot of attention.
Ryan Copeman, so let me give you a minute or two to look forward to see other issues around the country or perhaps coming to our state.
Well, we have a couple cases involving the governor that are coming to the Iowa Supreme Court very soon and are there now. Next month, we have oral argument in the Iowa Supreme Court in the case of Chris Godfrey versus Branstad, in which the governor reduced the salary of the Workers' Compensation Commissioner and spoke about the Workers' Compensation Commissioner's performance. Godfrey, the commissioner, said that that his comments were defamatory, that he breached contract. And now in front of the Iowa Supreme Court is the issue of whether the governor, his staff, are immune from those types of what are called common law claims. And then in addition, now we have another case that just went up dealing with the juvenile home. The governor and DHS closed the juvenile home recently, and then the head of AFSCME sued Danny Holman, as well as the governor's opponent, Senator Jack Hatch, sued to reopen the home, and a few weeks ago, an Iowa District Court judge ruled that the home does indeed have to be reopened. Branstad has appealed that ruling to the Iowa Supreme Court on an expedited basis and what's called an interlocutory appeal. Usually, the other party has 2 weeks to respond to such a request. The Iowa Supreme Court said, no, you only have 1 week. We want to know, plaintiffs, what you think about this right now. If I would have to guess, I'd say that we're going to see a reversal of that very shortly.
In our national news, we've also been seeing possible legal cases. I think you can either comment on this. The vendors denying services at same-sex weddings. Ryan?
Yeah, I think we'll see that coming to maybe the U.S. Supreme Court and possibly the Iowa Supreme Court. You know, in Iowa, we have a statute that says you cannot discriminate based on sexual orientation. New Mexico has the same statute, and we just had a case out of the New Mexico Supreme Court there, which held that it was not a violation of free speech or freedom of religion to require a photographer to photograph a same-sex wedding, even though the photographer has religious convictions that they say would prohibit them from doing so. So that case is now up to the United States Supreme Court. They've asked the court to take the case. And these same issues may very well percolate to the Iowa Supreme Court very soon.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that there's a legal history behind the signs that we've all seen at diners at various times. We reserve the right to deny service to anyone. Now, what is the history behind that? Ryan?
Well, of course, and you can reserve the right to refuse service to anyone so long as it is not a protected class, race, religion, sexual orientation in Iowa. But those are all statutory prohibitions. And so the question is whether the Constitution trumps that in this case. And of course, these aren't so much related to service in terms of I'm not going to serve you the meal, but about when you're engaging in something that's a religious ceremony or when you're engaging in something that's artistic, like photography. Does that trump these anti-discrimination statutes? And that's what the court will have to decide.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, we have about a minute left. I see Chief Justice Katie now holding office hours. Ryan, why would he be doing that?
Well, it's a great thing, I think. He's holding office hours in the Capitol. He's talking with legislators. He's been doing it for the last few years. And as you've noticed, the appropriations for the judicial branch have increased, and he's gaining a better relationship with those legislators and then therefore with their constituents. Basically, he's listening to people's concerns and problems about the judicial branch, not just the Iowa Supreme Court, but about district courts and all other facets of the courts, and people are responding favorably.
Mm-hmm. And also he's wanting to make people aware that he thinks that the judges need more pay?
Well, they weren't given a raise for quite a few years, and now he's asked for a 4.5% raise this year. He asked for it last year as well and got that. And the issue is always going to be, you know, judges make a lot of money. They make, you know, district court judges make around $137,000. But the question is whether you can recruit from private practice a sufficient number of qualified judges when people in private practice are increasingly making much more than that. So he's trying to get the best and brightest to the bench, and of course that affects us all, and at the end of the day may save the state millions if you have the right judges making the right decisions.
Ryan Copeman's attorney in Nymaster Goods Litigation Department, also editor and chief of the Iowa Appellate Blog On Brief. Ryan, thank you for coming into our Des Moines studio.
Thank you.
Todd Pettis, thank you. Associate Dean for Faculty in the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Always a pleasure to have you in as well.
Thanks.
We'll look forward to next time, Todd.
Thanks for the invitation.
And Charity Nebbe has stepped into our studio. Hi, Charity.
Hello, Ben.
How are you?
Good. And we've got a fun show coming up tomorrow on
Tell
Talk
us
of
about
Iowa.
It.
Well, you probably know, because I know you're going to the event, that the Moth is coming to
yes.
town. It's
oh,
going
yeah.
to be in Iowa City Friday evening at the Englert Theater, storytelling live without a script. And we're going to get a little bit of a preview of the show tomorrow on Talk of Iowa. We're also going to talk about storytelling and why the Moth has really taken off.
It
like
really
it has.
I just love that hour.
I know. It's a wonderful show. But also, you know, a few days ago, I talked to a storyteller, Kevin Kling, and he talked about how now is sort of becoming a golden era for storytellers, a new golden era. So we'll talk about that as well.
Okay. The Moth preview tomorrow on Talk of Iowa with Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on our program here, Politics Day, we'll talk about a number of actually domestic issues along with international issues. Hope you'll tune in. Joining the conversation for Politics Day tomorrow, Wednesday. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. John Pemble helped us out today in Des Moines. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.